This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 2nd, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that employment rose by over 300,000 jobs, but is this really a growth in employment? American soldiers could be on the verge of fighting another war in the Middle East. The Turkish army wants American troops to keep fighting against Turkish Kurd guerrillas. And in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, there are alarming indications of endemic sexual violence against women.
Women are discriminated against in our society. But for the victims of rape, it's the case that all of them face the worst discrimination.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some South Africans are finally receiving the long-time promised antiretroviral drugs. Naeem Jenner reports from Johannesburg.
Yesterday was an historic day in the fight against AIDS in South Africa. It was the beginning of the government's rollout of the provision of anti-AIDS drugs in public hospitals and began with five hospitals in the Gauteng province. Meanwhile, hundreds of patients have been queuing throughout the province to be tested ahead of receiving the drugs. Gauteng Premier Mbazima Shiloa assured patients that this would be a sustainable program. The province plans to have 23 sites dispensing antiretroviral drugs by next year. Today, South Africa's former president, Nelson Mandela, called on AIDS patients to demand that leaders give them the medicines and treatment they require. South Africa has 5 million HIV-positive people, higher than any other country. Last year, the Western Cape province, tired of waiting for the National Health Department, unilaterally began dispensing the drugs. In Johannesburg, I'm Naeem Jina for Free Speech Radio News.
Public radio and television host Tavis Smiley intended to give his corporate underwriter a chance to defend themselves, but the 30-minute program turned into a positive spin opportunity for Walmart. Knock Wynn reports from Los Angeles.
Show host Tavis Smiley said he had received emails accusing him of, quote, being in bed with Walmart. The world's largest employer has been criticized for anti-union policies and setting an anti-labor trend with its low wage and poor benefit jobs. One email berated the public TV show for accepting underwriting from a corporation it called anti-community and pointed to a conflict of interest. So Smiley invited Walmart president and CEO H. Lee Scott on the show to set the record straight. Scott says his successful company is getting a bad rap. After all, if it's so bad, why do 1 million people work there and 100 million shop there? Answering the anti-labor claims, the CEO said the company will spend $2 billion this year on health care and boasted that 70% of managers started out on the Walmart sales floor. 40% of Walmart employees aren't signed up for the company's health plan, though. They can't afford it. Smiley neglected to bring that up, instead changing the subject to a topic he said he was personally interested in, quote, the business philosophy of Walmart. For FSRN, I'm Nak Nguyen in Los Angeles.
Local, district, and federal environmental authorities are pointing fingers at each other while thousands of residents cope with lead-contaminated water. Megan Britton has more from D.C.
The Environmental Protection Agency accused the Washington Water and Sewer Authority of endangering public health by failing to properly notify residents in the nation's capital about the high levels of lead in the drinking water. The EPA's conclusion came months after the dangerous levels of lead were discovered. Eric Olson, a senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council, said the Sewer and Water Authority engaged in cover-up, while the EPA neglected the problem.
Pointing fingers is not going to make the drinking water any safer or any faster in Washington. What we need is, we think, the federal government to declare an emergency and the district government to declare an emergency.
According to Olson, the effects of the lead-contaminated water are already being seen in school children in the area. Olson also stressed that the problem in Washington, D.C. highlights a nationwide lead problem and suggested that federal agencies take action across the nation. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Megan Britton.
The Cyprus Reunification Plan, drawn up by the United Nations Secretary General, will be put to a referendum later this month, despite its rejection by leaders of the island's Greek and Turkish sides. Susan Wood has more from the U.N.
U.N. officials said Special Envoy Alvaro de Soto would present the plan at a public meeting of the Security Council. but would not seek endorsement from the 15-nation body. The council was, however, expected to issue a statement urging Greek and Turkish Cypriots to approve the plan in dual referendums on April 24th. Rejection by either community would mean that only the wealthier Greek South would join the European Union on May 1st, leaving the poorer Turkish North internationally isolated. The plan calls for a federal republic composed of two equal states, one Turkish Cypriot and one Greek Cypriot. But while Turkish Cypriots are expected to narrowly approve the referendum over their leaders' objections, polls suggest more than 70% of Greek Cypriots reject proposals to limit their property rights in a future Turkish Cypriot state. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that employment rose by over 300,000 jobs, which may be considered good news for the Bush administration, but at the same time, the unemployment rate slightly rose to 8.4 million people, and that number does not include the 4.8 million people who stopped looking for work, or the 4.7 million people who found new work but a considerable cut in pay from their previous job. Our DC editor Mitch Jeserich reports.
Over the past 6 months, the U.S. economy has produced on average 60,000 jobs a month, well below the 125,000 needed just to keep pace with the monthly growth in the labor force. So it was welcome news today at the White House when the Bureau of Labor Statistics announced that 308,000 jobs were created in March. Still, the unemployment rate also rose slightly to 5.7%. Overall losses are being blamed on increased productivity and the outsourcing of jobs. But Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama says such things will eventually lead to more employment.
Increased productivity means that a plant, a factory, a business is doing better than they've done before. They're producing more widgets at less cost and less employment, and they're more efficient. This, in the long run, is good. In the short run, it could mean an increase in unemployment. This has made us competitive in the world market. If you don't have productivity increases, how can a high-wage country like the United States compete with other countries around the world who pay less wages?
While over 300,000 jobs were gained in March, average wages did not significantly rise, according to the labor statistics, as a majority of those jobs came in the traditionally low-wage service sector.
So they may be working, but going into a Walmart or going into hamburger flipping is not as good a job as the ones we're losing.
Democratic Senator John Corzine of New Jersey says this increase in jobs does not necessarily bode well for the overall economy. The Bureau of Labor Statistics indicates that there are 8.4 million people who are unemployed. Not included in that number is the 4.8 million people who have stopped looking for work, or the millions of unemployed people with disabilities who have been stigmatized as unemployable. Another troubling number within the statistics is the 4.7 million people like Joseph Mustalo of Littleton, Colorado, who found lower-paying jobs after losing higher-paying ones.
I was a crane operator for 40 years, and I'm currently a school bus driver in the Littleton School District, and I'm making half of what I was making. I've lost my 401k. It's all gone. All my savings is all gone. And it only took a very short period of time for that to all go. By the time you pay all your bills, your obligations, and groceries and gas, it goes fast.
Do you think there's a lack of jobs out there right now?
Yes, very much so. But what's killing the United States right now is the outsourcing. They're sending all the jobs out of the country.
The number of jobs affected by foreign outsourcing or offshoring is really quite small. We're talking maybe 300,000 or 400,000 jobs in the last few years in an economy that employs almost 140 million people.
Dan Wiswald is an economist with the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. He and other economists say the outsourcing of jobs is just a small factor in the unemployment rate.
We're not creating jobs because the workers who are employed are so much more productive because of computers, because of better management, and that sort of thing. We're more productive. So in the long run, this is good news for the economy because wages tend to go up with productivity.
Wiswald and others, like Chairman of the Federal Reserve Alan Greenspan, call for a transformation of the U.S. labor force. They say in an ever-increasing global economy, the U.S. should position its people to take high-end jobs. But can the U.S. realistically create that many positions without leaving some people behind? Heather Boucher is an economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research.
That is one of my concerns in this focus only on high-end workers, that we have to get everyone a college degree and that will solve our problem. What's going to happen to those folks that don't have that degree? And I think we need to be just as concerned about creating good jobs for them and ensuring that the jobs available to folks with less education are good jobs.
I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
American soldiers could be on the verge of fighting another war in the Middle East. In Washington for meetings with U.S. military leaders, the deputy chief of the Turkish Army General Staff demanded that the U.S. Army start fighting against approximately 5,000 Turkish-Kurdish guerrillas holed up in camps in snow-capped mountains of northern Iraq. After a bloody 20-year civil war and more than 30,000 mostly civilian casualties, the PKK withdrew from Turkey and called a unilateral ceasefire with their leader Abdullah Öcalan, who was captured 4 years ago. But as Aaron Glantz reports from Baghdad, the Turkish army wants American troops to keep fighting.
After meeting with senior American military officials in Washington, the deputy chairman of the Turkish army faced reporters. The general, Ilker Basburg, told reporters the Bush administration agreed to take what he called concrete steps against the PKK before handing over authority to the Iraqi Governing Council at the end of June. In response to a question from the Turkish press, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, offered this statement.
This is an issue that the coalition forces inside Iraq take very seriously. Without going into any of the operational details, let me just assure you that there is very close collaboration on this with Turkey, that they will be dealt with appropriately.
Kurdish leaders say they're doing everything they can to make peace with the Turkish army. For 4 years, they've honored a unilateral ceasefire called by their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, from his island prison in the Aegean Sea. Özlem Bulcal, editor of the Kurdish interest newspaper Free Agenda, based in Istanbul, notes the Kurdish fighters in northern Iraq have repeatedly tried to turn in their arms.
For example, there is news on the reaction of the people against the arrest of Ali Sapan, who is a PKK guerrilla and who came down from the mountains for a solution to the Kurdish problem as a peace delegate. Their talks on the Kurdish problem resembles the talks the Zapatistas had with the Mexican state. The Zapatistas wanted to talk with the state directly, so Marcos walked down to Mexico City to talk with the president. Ali Sapan had come for a similar meeting. He was arrested. He's been in prison for more than 4 years now. He's in an isolated cell.
In addition to filling Turkey's jails with Kurdish leaders, the Turkish army continues to maintain two bases in northern Iraq, one near the border and the other in the middle of one of northern Iraq's largest cities, Erbil. At home, Turkish prosecutors moved last week to ban the country's largest Kurdish political party, DEHAP, on the grounds that it supports terrorism. The Kurdish language remains largely banned from Turkish television and radio. Under new broadcast regulations approved in January, Kurdish can be broadcast just 2 hours a day, and even then there are conditions. Menti Perinçek is on the executive board of Turkey's Human Rights Association, which is suing over the new regulations.
With these laws, Kurdish programs can only be broadcast on national television with subtitles in Turkish. But for the local radios, it's illegal. No children's programming is allowed. It's a big hardship because the children can't learn Kurdish in school and they forget their own language. The children have a right to learn in their mother tongue. In this law, we don't have this right. Also, they want subtitles in Turkish. This is a big hardship because there is no academic atmosphere for the Kurdish in Turkey.
Iraqi Kurds, by contrast, have enjoyed the patronage of the United States for more than a decade, and as a consequence have been able to build schools and media institutions where Kurdish is exclusively spoken. Hakim Umar of Iraq's Patriotic Union of Kurdistan's Foreign Office says Iraqi Kurds aren't willing to risk losing that in a confrontation with the American and Turkish armies. But he thinks the United States should think twice before opening up a new front in the Kurdish mountains.
maybe they don't fight the PKK, but, you know, it's very difficult in this mountain to find someone and to fight them and to take them out. It's difficult. It's Saddam Hussein, during the 30 years, he couldn't finish us in the mountains. Even all America now can't finish Bin Laden and Zawahiri in Afghanistan. It's difficult, but they try. They will try, and they're supporting the Turkish people to fight the PKK, not to fight the Kurdish from Iraq.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
In the aftermath of the release of five British prisoners from Guantanamo Bay in Cuba back to Britain, the first public meeting of the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission took place in London. On their return, the men were detained for questioning by the British police in what one lawyer describes as window dressing for the Americans, before being released without any charges being laid. Naomi Fowler attended the commission and brings us this report.
There are still four Britons being held in Guantanamo. Muazzam Beg is one of those men. A devout Muslim, he was taken away by the US in Pakistan, where he was setting up a school for basic literacy and numeracy. He was in Afghanistan installing water pumps in remote villages. His father, Asmak Beg, talks about the conditions his son is experiencing in Guantanamo.
In the night when it's too cold, they blow cold air into the cells. And in the days when it's too hot, they blow hot air in the cages. So this is the condition of the prisoners there. The people who say that we are champion of civilization, we are the creator of democracy, are doing this.
Raul Ahmed was released from Guantanamo last month. His parents made this statement.
We are happy beyond description for his return, but he's not the young man that he was when he went away. He's now very solitary, emotionally detached from his family. He does not wish to be seen outside the house. We are worried about the long-term effects on him of what he has been through, emotionally, psychologically, and physically, because amongst other things, while he was at Guantanamo, he was forcibly injected. Nobody knows what was in these injections.
John Hemming of the Liberal Democrat Party.
On the 9th of August, 1971, 395 people were interned without charge and without trial in Northern Ireland. Now, many of the documents say that the biggest mistake during the Troubles in Northern Ireland was internment. And there is an argument that internment in itself made the situation worse. In many ways, that is really one of the lessons that needs to be learnt by this government and also by the Americans.
British detainees released recently confirmed that British security services were complicit in their detention and interrogated them, despite the British government publicly maintaining their opposition to the detentions. Founder of the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission, Corinne Redgrave.
Now it's perfectly clear that British security services took advantage of the lawless place where they were imprisoned to conduct interrogations which in Britain would have been unlawful. Not once has this government come out and said that there is no way in which military tribunals are an acceptable substitute for justice and the rule of law. And until they say that, there is great danger. And we must make them say that or get rid of them. That is what we have to do. Because if we fail to do that, we will have failed in the battle against terrorism, we will have failed to protect ourselves, we will have failed to protect our children, and we will have failed, therefore, all of our responsibilities.
Mr. Beg, father of Muazzam Beg, who is still being held in Guantanamo.
I have asked for justice. Justice means a proper justice in the court of law, not justice in military tribunal, where the judge will be a military man, the prosecutor will be a military man, and the defendant's lawyer will be a military man, and most probably the executor will be a military man. So I don't want that sort of justice.
The Guantanamo Human Rights Commission continues to lobby for the release or fair trials for all those held in Guantanamo Bay, as well as the remaining four British detainees. This is Naomi Fowler in Birmingham for Free Speech Radio News.
In Tampa, Florida, it's illegal to distribute food to the homeless in public parks. In an act of civil disobedience, a group of young activists with the Food Not Bombs organization ran into problems with the police as they attempted to hand out sandwiches and juice in a public park. Tampa police officers Lieutenant Blackham and Lieutenant Jill Ramston took the activist's name, arrested one of them, and gave the rest a warning to not come back to the park. While many of the activists chose to take their food this past weekend to another park in the area, a couple of them courageously came back. Ferhad Saibet reports from Tampa.
As expected, Lieutenant Blackham arrived at the park at 1 p.m. sharp. He walked up to the young teenager he recognized from last week. The teenager, who asked to be recognized as Jimmy, was sitting on the grass area looking down as if he'd been waiting for this moment for the whole week. The officer approached him, asked a couple of questions, but Jimmy was not answering. So the officer took out his cuffs, put them on Jimmy, lifted him by his biceps and pulled him across the park, passing in front of all those Jimmy had just fed.
You want me to carry you over there like luggage? I want you to stand up. Since you're going to be drugged, I'll drag you. You don't want to walk under your own power.
Jimmy seemed like a corpse who was first dragged through the grass, then onto the red brick pavement, to finally being set face down on the ground by the police car.
Now you have two choices. You can stand up and sit down in the car, or it's not going to be comfortable. What's it going to be?
The officer opened the car door, threw Jimmy face down on the back seat, and smashed the door before getting in the driver's seat. Jimmy and other witnesses like indie media journalist Charles Suggs all confirmed that Jimmy was not read his ride before being put in the police car. Lieutenant Blackham refused to make any comment. The second person being arrested was Lily Lewis, who was just there to help bring the food.
For the purposes of coming here and feeding, if you're not going to get a permit, don't come in the park.
Okay.
That's what you're here for, so you're under arrest also.
Sir, I was about to leave. We were not here.
I explained the consequences to you. You come in the park.
So you told me to leave or else I wouldn't get arrested, and I'm leaving.
And you know what? Someone else talked to you, but I have your name in my car, so you're going to take the ride too.
But we did not come here to feed people in Massey Park. We just came here to get the food that was left over from when you were arrested.
So we're going to walk over here.
Other members of the organization soon began to arrive to gather the food left over and clean the area.
I think we're going to continue to share food with people.
Sarah Stromsky is also a member of the Food Not Bombs organization.
I mean, if people are hungry, then we don't see why we should have to go through some sort of red tape system in order to share the food that we happen to be blessed with, that we happen to have found or have. At the same time, though, we want to try and fight this whole law about not being allowed to feed the homeless people in public parks. Because I'm sure a lot of people in Tampa don't even know that it's illegal to feed people in our own parks.
Corporal Larry Timmer, who was the day's acting sergeant, said, "From outside looking in, it may not make sense. But when you are in the inside and you are hearing complaints constantly from these property owners and their issues, it does make sense."
What's happening here is obviously you don't agree, or people don't agree with this law that exists here, reference to a permit. It doesn't make sense to challenge us, but maybe they want to challenge the courts, and maybe you got to get arrested first. I don't know. But we'll accommodate you if that's the case.
Many of the homeless people present were infuriated by the whole episode. Gulf War I veteran Serge Van Soyl.
When I saw this, I said, man, what kind of world is this? You know, I mean, this is a reverse world. You know, how can this young kid go to jail for feeding the homeless? And I'm a homeless war vet.
Another person enjoying the food there was Charles Hinkle.
It's what America's about. Bothering somebody that's hungry. It's totally ridiculous.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Farad Sabit in Tampa, Florida.
The government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo announced today that the alleged coup attempt this past weekend will not disrupt the timetable for holding elections. The elections will be held amid rising fear in the population, where it's estimated that since 1998, more than 3 million people have lost their lives as a result of the Congo civil war. A peace process is in place, but on the ground, many Congolese are exposed to a reality very different to any peace. Tribal fighters and former rebels, the International Medical Organization says, have raped thousands of women in eastern Congo. FSRN correspondent Rupert Cook reports.
Weimana is a 32-year-old widow from the North Kivu region in eastern Congo. Here she's describing how, about 18 months ago, her village was attacked repeatedly over several days by Interahamwe militia, the remnants of the militias which fled Rwanda after perpetrating the genocide in 1994. Livestock was stolen, many people were killed, some were shot, others herded into their houses and burnt alive. Wemana was abducted by a group of three men who took her into the forests. They beat and raped her repeatedly. After 2 weeks, one of them felt pity and let her go. Wemana returned to the ruins of her home and discovered that she was pregnant. She lost the child at birth. The rape had left her with internal injuries, and she developed fistula, with incontinence from both bowel and bladder. Most of Wemana's extended family had been killed in the raid on her village. Her trauma and physical injuries were compounded by a double ostracism, both for having been a victim of rape and worse still for her incontinence. Justine Masika runs the Protestant Women's Federation of North Kivu, which devotes much of its time to helping survivors of sexual violence recover from their injuries and psychological trauma.
La femme est toujours discriminée ici chez nous.
Women are discriminated against in our society, but for the victims of rape, it's the case that all of them face the worst discrimination. But we're trying to offer them help without any discrimination. Once a girl has been raped, she is rejected by her family and she is also rejected by society because it is considered shameful. Here, when a family has a girl, they look forward to her getting married and then they will receive the dowry. But when a girl has been raped, it is so shameful and they know they won't receive the dowry. And that means that the girl is no longer worth anything.
I met Wemana in a hospital run by a US-based NGO called DOCS, or Doctors on Call for Service, in Goma, a town in eastern Congo on the border with Rwanda. The DOCS hospital is in fact a teaching centre, offering Congolese medics the opportunity to qualify professionally through distance learning. But in recent years they've developed a new speciality, reconstructive surgery for the victims of sexual violence. Lynn Lucy is the administrator of the DOCS hospital in Goma.
It's a very serious problem. These militias and bandit gangs are geographically located. In this region, it's definitely the Interahamwe who have recruited all the dregs of society from all sorts of origins. Women have always been treated as objects, and what these bandits are doing is just taking to extremes what is in general an attitude of society towards women.
Some local women's groups speak of hundreds of thousands of victims. Sexual violence is also becoming more widespread among civilians, its incidents rising in the towns. Outside observers are increasingly concerned about a culture of impunity. Johannes Widenek is head of the UNICEF Office for Eastern Congo.
Well, it's a very serious problem. There is impunity, there was impunity. The crimes were committed by all the armed groups. The issue is, of course, in a transitional phase, how to deal with impunity. And I think it's a step-by-step process, because you also have to bear in mind the protection of the victim, the protection of all the witnesses. It's a very difficult question, which in the end we have to strengthen the system. We have to advocate to lift impunity, to reinstall the right, the law. We have to work on the environment to make sure that she can get justice.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Goma, the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.